Thank you, Liz, and may I add my welcome to you to the first of Herriot seminar series celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Can I begin by acknowledging the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, whose traditional lands we're on today. Ladies and gentlemen, the Universal Declaration was adopted by the United Nations General Assembly on the 10th of December 1948. It consists, I think as many as you would know, of a preamble and 30 articles which set out a broad range of fundamental human rights and freedoms which all men and women everywhere in the world are entitled without discrimination to enjoy. And the Declaration in its core values, inherent to human dignity, non-discrimination, equality, fairness and universality, apply to everyone, everywhere, every day and always. The Declaration is the foundation of international human rights law. It was the first universal statement of the basic principles of inalienable human rights, and it sets a common standard for all peoples in all nations. And as the Declaration approaches its 60th birthday, it is this Commission's intention to emphasise the living document's enduring relevance, its universality and its application to all of us in a series of seminars which will be open to the public. Now, the present seminar is, unfortunately, appropriately entitled Climate Change and Human Rights, a Tragedy in the Making, because although climate change will clearly have human rights impacts, the focus of government seems to have been largely on economic, trade and security impacts of climate change, with the social and human rights implications not receiving much consideration in public debates. The interim report of the Gano Climate Change Review has made some progress, I think, in distancing itself from the business as usual approach, but there's still no express mention made of the impact of climate change on human rights. So I welcome this opportunity to look at climate change through what we might call the human rights lens. And I hope I can show that the values of non-discrimination, equality and fairness, which are the very foundations of the Universal Declaration, offer some useful guiding principles for our responses and the government responses to climate change. When climate change is viewed through the human rights lens, the picture looks very different from the scientific statistics and economic forecasts we generally hear. The human rights lens shows us that populations becoming increasingly vulnerable to poverty and social deprivation as large tracts of previously fertile land have become useless. And we can, I think, anticipate conflicts over limited water supplies becoming more frequent and more serious. We see problems in controlling infectious diseases, which are also spreading wider. We see rising sea levels and storm surges submerging coastal areas and atoll countries and delta regions, and making them uninhabitable, not simply because they disappear, but because the seawater gets into the freshwater sources. These are scenarios that are directly threaten fundamental human rights to food, to a place to live, a place to work, as well as rights to shelter and property, rights associated with livelihood, culture, migration and resettlement, and indeed they can affect the very right to life itself. So the human rights lens brings into reality, I think, the importance of considering the position of the world's poor and marginalised, people who are already in precarious situations, and as Liz has observed, all too often women, and I would add children. These groups are likely to be disproportionately affected by climate change, and the climate change will exacerbate existing social inequality both locally and internationally, and I am speaking today with an eye to the international scene as well as the local one. This is the result because populations whose rights are poorly protected now are likely to be those less well equipped to understand and prepare for climate change. they are ones that are more likely to lack the resources that will be needed to enable them to adapt to the expected alterations in their environments and economic circumstances. I think we can anticipate conflicts over limited resources becoming more frequent and severe, as I said, and at times, I regret, violent, as a result of climate change. International Alert, a UK-based non-government organisation, has already identified 46 countries, which are the home to some 2.7 billion people, where the impacts of climate change interacting with economic, social and political problems will create a high risk of violent conflict. They've identified a further 56 countries where they believe the institutions of government will have great difficulty taking the strain of climate change on top of their other current challenges. And a number of these countries, of course, are in the Asia-Pacific region. Critically, food production in Asia is said to decrease by as much as 20% as a result of climate change by 2050. That's going to affect some 1 billion people. It is in this context that the Garnaut Climate Change Review draft report, which was released in July 2008, warns that Australia is set to experience the ripple effect of climate-induced political disturbances and even violent conflict in the region. With climate change becoming a key topic in national and global politics, the first response has been to pursue measures to mitigate its rate of acceleration, for example by curbing greenhouse gas emissions through the introduction of an emissions trading scheme scheduled to commence in Australia in 2010. And we are presently in the midst of further discussions on an agreement to replace the Kyoto Protocol once it expires in 2012. The Bali Mandate, named after the conference in Bali in December 2007, set a course for long-term cooperative action and witnessed Australia's signature to the Kyoto Protocol and the announcement by the Prime Minister of Australia that by 2050 Australia would reduce emissions by 60% over the 2000 levels. The Bali Mandate for the first time has also seen developing countries committing to preparation for mitigation action supported by technology and financing in a measurable, reportable and verifiable way. But recognising that climate change is going to continue, hopefully at a reduced rate, but continue, attempts have also been considered to adapt to its effects. Australia and other developed nations have already accepted financial obligations under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change to assist developing nations implement global adaptation programs. But regrettably to date, the input, financial input in particular, to those schemes has been very disappointing indeed. So much so that Archbishop Desmond Tutu has argued that we are drifting into a world of adaptation apartheid, where the world's poorest left to sink or swim through a problem that's not of their making, while citizens of the rich world are protected from harm. And Liz has already referred to an African situation this morning. Importantly, there are promising signs that this approach is being more supported and things are changing. Australia's most recent budget committed $150 million over 3 years to assist countries in our region to assess and adapt to likely impacts of climate change on their coastal communities and infrastructure, their agricultural sectors and their health sectors. The new Rudd government, I think, should be congratulated for this very valuable step towards reducing the impact of climate change in our region. Yet differential impact of climate change is not limited to developing and developed countries. Within Australia, it has been predicted that northern Aboriginal communities will bear the brunt of climate change, with more than 100,000 people facing serious health risks from malaria, dengue fever and heat stress, as well as loss of food sources from floods, droughts and more intense bushfires. It's also been forecast as a possibility that in the Torres Strait Islands at least 8,000 people will lose their homes if the sea level rises by 1 metre. And of course you may have read in the Sydney Morning Herald today that there are forecasts being considered that in the next century it could rise by even 1.5 metres. In some areas, the effects of climate change are already being experienced by Indigenous people, particularly on island communities along the coastlines of Australia, and those Indigenous groups whose lives and maintenance of culture depends on the Murray-Darling River. At the recent United Nations Permanent Forum in New York, Indigenous peoples from around the world voiced their concerns that due to their cultural and spiritual relationship with the land, climate change posed particular risks to the very survival of their communities. And Emily Gerard will address some of those issues today, but very importantly point out that while some of us look at the gloomy side of all these things, there will be in some areas some balancing considerations, so that perhaps another dimension of this problem is how communities, governments are going to mediate a fair balance of changing interests in a social and economic situation. Given that climate change is already affecting a broad range of internationally protected human rights, the question which I pose is what, if anything, does the modern human rights regime require from governments when developing appropriate responses to climate change? And in my view, the answer is that the human rights regime offers a lot, despite the fact that mainstream climate change literature and debate has, at least until very recently, had virtually nothing to say about human rights. As the precise connection between human rights and climate change is still developing, I think I need to say a little by way of background about the notion of human rights and why I think it's justifiable to assert that human rights principles do establish normative benchmarks that governments should comply with. The modern notion of human rights is one founded in international law, and it traces back to and is based on the Universal Declaration, which makes today's topic important, I think. The Declaration builds from the premise in the first article that all humans are born free and equal in dignity and rights. The major human rights treaties, which we now know or now have, were, of course, developed before climate change was understood to be a looming threat to human society. However, there are many broad rights recognised in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, as well as in the Convention Against Torture and the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which are relevant to the situations of people whose way of life is going to come under threat from climate change. These broad rights establish international norms for the protection of the right to life, to personal security, and to the basic necessities of life, that is, clean water, food, shelter, minimum health care, and so on. Further, the fundamental concept which underpins these human rights treaties, namely that all are equal before the law and are entitled to its protection without discrimination, are particularly relevant in developing responses to the impact of climate change. As a signatory to these human rights instruments, Australia has agreed to respect, protect and fulfil the rights contained within them. The obligation to respect means Australia must refrain from interfering with or curtailing enjoyment of human rights. The obligation to protect requires Australia to protect individuals and groups against human rights abuses, whether by government or by private actors. And the obligation to fulfil means that states must take positive action to facilitate the enjoyment of basic human rights. Thus, irrespective of the cause of a threat to human rights, Australia has positive obligations to use all the means within its disposal to uphold the human rights that may be affected. And this is particularly important, I think, in the present debate, where the actual causes of climate change, responsibilities for greenhouse gas emissions, etc., are very difficult to ascertain and to be clear about. However, the legal force of the rights protected in international treaties within Australia is not so clear-cut. On the one hand, by signing up to the international treaties, Australia has made the undertakings I've referred to the international community, to ensure people within its jurisdiction, within Australia, enjoy the recognised rights. But on the other hand, when international human rights law establishes these broad rights, they don't automatically become the law of the land in Australia. It's necessary for Parliament to take the further step to enact these provisions into our domestic law. And whilst Australia has signed up to a lot of these conventions, not many of the rights in them that are relevant to climate change have actually been expressly enacted into our law. And particularly that's the case with the rights recognised in the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. Nevertheless, I think the fact that Australia has signed up to these conventions doesn't mean that because they're not expressly enacted, they're not relevant in Australia to administrative decision making. Many of you, I think, will be aware of the famous High Court case of Teo, where the High Court said in 1995 that decisions made under our domestic laws by the executive arm of government needed to have regard to the fact that the Australian community was entitled to have a legitimate expectation that bureaucrats would act in accordance with Australia's international treaty obligations, even though the treaty hadn't been expressly enacted into local law. That case has been doubted at times, but I think the general view now is that it is good law, and the government seem to be respecting it more and more. So I think it's reasonable to argue, and I think to expect, that in developing policy and legislative responses to climate change, Australia will respect its international human rights obligations. Whether particular climate change responses relate to local communities in Australia, to immigration policies for people seeking to come to Australia, to escape environmental catastrophes in their homelands, or to funding for adaptation measures overseas, a human rights-based approach to policy development could, and I would urge, should be the benchmark against which policy and resource allocation is evaluated. I've already observed that the low-income and disadvantaged people will not only be at the forefront of climate change impacts, but may also be disproportionately affected by adaptation measures pursued for the purposes of minimising or dealing with risks associated with climate change. For instance, I think the focus on shifting energy sources to low-carbon alternatives is likely to mean the more widespread introduction of minimum energy performance standards for electrical appliances, for cars, for buildings, and for many aspects of community life. But the other side of that is that it will increase the costs of all these items, and it will increase the costs to users. Pricing carbon into energy will mean that the cost of electricity is likely to go up. And it takes little imagination to see that in all these areas it is those that are already disadvantaged that are going to have to struggle with increased costs. Applying a human rights-based approach would address these inequalities that arise in the adaptation and mitigation processes. First, a human rights-based approach would encourage transparent and participatory processes for decision-making. And for the implementation and monitoring, etc., of the measures taken. By focusing on individuals as rights holders, the responsibility is placed on government to allow for their participation and input in designing and implementing projects. Applying that, I think, would mean, for example, that Indigenous people would be considered as major stakeholders in an emissions trading scheme, and that their custodial role over traditional lands means that the flow-on impacts of environmental protection and the care for country must be fully taken into account in developing strategies. Then B, beyond these procedural issues, a human rights-based approach would also guide policymakers about the substantive elements of the adaptation measures that are taken. Important questions about impact scenarios would be who precisely is to suffer and what and why from the climate change measures. A human rights-based approach would apply the principle of non-discrimination and substantive equality, so that when a climate change policy is put forward, decision makers would need to identify the impact it would have on the most disadvantaged and vulnerable, as far as possible using data disaggregated according to the prohibited grounds of discrimination. For example, you would look individual separately at race, colour, sex, national and geographical origins, and see how people in those different groups would be affected. And if the result of an adaptation measure, for instance, is that a particular group, say the Indigenous people, are going to be disproportionately impacted, well then it's necessary to make some adjustments to the scheme to address that particular inequality. Under a human rights-based approach, the substantive elements of any new measure would need to ensure that the fundamental rights of everybody affected by the measure are taken into account and balanced in a non-discriminatory way. And those rights should of necessity incorporate minimum standards of political and civil rights, including personal security, as well as economic, social and cultural rights. Water, food and housing would be the most basic and important rights to ensure that the right to life was meaningful. And human rights standards would guide policymakers and legislators when weighing competing demands for limited resources, helping to ensure, for example, that budget allocations prioritise the most marginalised and disadvantaged groups. The authoritative general comments on human rights from human rights treaty bodies, I think, are a useful articulation of the content of some of these human rights which are going to arise in the climate change situation. To take just as one example, a relocated community would have to be provided with minimum requirements of fresh water. Now, currently the World Health Organization has a standard 7.5 litres per day per person, and it would be incumbent upon the policymakers to ensure that there is that amount of water physically and financially available to every adult and every child, and that it would be accessible without discrimination on any of the prohibited grounds of sex, age and so on. And you need to ensure personal security is protected so that you can actually get the water without being threatened by others that might want it ahead of you. So there are a set of standards already available that could be taken into account to deal with that one right to fresh water. But there's similar standards and guidelines set down by the treaty bodies which have addressed right to food, right to health, right to adequate housing and so on. So there's a wealth of information and resource material there. A human rights-based approach could be applied through a process that required the introduction of new legislation-based policies to be accompanied by a human rights compliance statement. Now, any of you that have been involved in the Charter of Rights debates will be well familiar with the notion of compliance statements, but that sort of process would ensure that in the policy formulation, governments would go through a process which is very similar to that required under the Charters of Rights in the United Kingdom, New Zealand, Australian Capital Territory, and Victoria, and so on. Human rights issues for Australia that will arise where displaced populations cross their national boundaries raise additional issues. As others have observed, desperate, hungry, homeless people are likely to cross borders and cross oceans. It takes us back to look at Australia in the past couple of decades, where we have experienced the movement of people, refugees escaping from persecution. And I have to say that Australia's legislative response to these so-called unlawful non-citizens left a certain amount to be desired. We had had this policy of mandatory detention and indefinite detention for failed asylum seekers that up until at least mid-December 2007 even involved the Pacific solution. Something needs to be done to address what might happen if we get more people coming across the sea. And I think in this context we must welcome Senator Evans' commitment last month to reform the current detention regime and provide a more humane treatment for those who are seeking our protection. But I think we need to acknowledge that the flow of human traffic in the past might turn out to look like a trickle in the future. The International Federation of Red Cross announced this year that climate change disasters are currently a bigger cause of population displacement than war and persecution. According to our report published by the United Nations University, there are now about 19.2 million people officially recognised as people or persons of concern, and that is people who are likely to be displaced by impending environmental disasters. And there are current estimates that range between 25 million and 1 billion people that are going to need to be resettled by 2050. One of the international treaties that followed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was the Refugee Convention in 1951. We hear a lot today about a class of climate or environmental refugees, but they are not people that fit into the profile of persons entitled to protection under the Refugee Convention. Indeed, that convention offers them, I think, no protection whatsoever. The Refugees Convention was developed to deal with people fleeing from civil and political persecution, and it just simply doesn't cover people that are moving because their homes have been destroyed. People obviously can't be returned to their island state if the island no longer exists. And currently we have in our own area here Kiribati, which is facing the prospect of becoming uninhabitable, mainly because of the loss of its water supply, and many low-lying islands in the Pacific, in Tuvalu, some in Papua New Guinea, some in the Torres Strait, some in the Marshall Islands, which are facing the prospect of disappearing completely. And these are people that are going to turn to Australia as well as to other places for assistance and protection. International law is clear, quite apart from the Refugee Convention, that non-citizens are not to be returned to the border of another country where their safety is at risk of torture, cruelty or inhumane treatment. And it seems to me to be pretty obvious that it would be inhumane to try and return somebody to a country that was no longer able to reasonably and adequately provide for food, housing, water and so on. So we're going to have a lot of people that find their way to our shores that somehow or other Australia and others are going to have to manage. How Australia will treat unauthorised arrivals that really are in desperate need of protection is going to be the pressing question. And at this point in time, international law does not really offer a ready solution to this. Solutions are going to have to be developed. It's going to require inventive and creative thinking and a lot of goodwill on the part of the communities that are able to offer assistance. It seems fairly obvious that there is a need for new treaty negotiation to develop something like the Refugee Convention that is going to deal with people that need permanent resettlement and also those that are going to need temporary protection immediately following areas of events of disaster by drought, storm and so on. So a lot of work needs to be done there, and hopefully that is an area where our government will show considerable leadership in the international community. So, ladies and gentlemen, the values that inspired the drafters of the Universal Declaration, I think, provide a powerful point of reference that is very appropriate in the climate change context. That document was an international response to human tragedy of extreme nationalism, fascism and world war. It established a set of entitlements and rights, civil, political, cultural, social, economic, for, in its words, all members of the human family, and to prevent the disregard and contempt for human rights that have resulted in barbarous acts that have outraged the conscience of mankind. The drafters of the Universal Declaration were, of course, looking back at a human tragedy that had occurred. I think we are now looking forward to human rights tragedy that is still in the making. Although the Gano Climate Change Review describes climatic change as a diabolical policy problem, harder than any other issue of high importance that has come before our polity in living memory, I would suggest that human rights principles may at least help to return focus to human rights suffering that climate change is causing and will continue to cause, and will help us to remain attentive to human rights and indicate ways in which policies can be developed that will respect them. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you.